This year, the people of Papua New Guinea will be heading to the polls to decide who will represent them in their national parliament. Since Papua New Guinea's independence in 1975, there's only been 7 women to serve in its national parliament. Currently, there are no women. But it's not for a lack of trying. Record numbers of women contested Papua New Guinea's 2017 elections, but unfortunately, none were successful. Hello, and welcome to the AusPNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast where we talk about Papua New Guinea's pressing issues for women seeking greater political representation. My name is Jessica Collins. I'm a research fellow in the AusPNG Network and Pacific Islands program here at the Institute. Today, we are going to dive into the issues for Papua New Guinean women who are trying to get into politics. And I'm delighted to be speaking with Teresa Mecki, Pacific Research Fellow in the Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Teresa's research focuses on women's presence in Papua New Guinea's election history. She also recently submitted her PhD thesis on Oro women's political participation in Papua New Guinea's 2017 national election. Teresa, congratulations on your submission, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
So historically, women have had a tough time getting elected to Papua New Guinea's parliament, and right now there are none serving as a member. Can you tell us about the general experience for Papua New Guinean women in politics?
So most women, when they come out of contesting, you'll hear them talk of how taxing it is, how emotionally draining, how financially draining it is. A lot of resources and preparation and time goes into the whole experience. So it's not just the 8 weeks of campaigning that's tiresome for them. It's a collective of activities that they've done prior to the election period to establish themselves as leaders. On top of that, with the actual campaigning and, you know, just the logistics of traveling around PNG, especially during election time, things get very expensive, hiring cars, getting posters, and all of that logistical, technical nature of campaigning is very expensive. And then we have the added political culture that's very conducive to clientelism, politics, corruption, all of that it just makes it an enormous task. So that's the three things that you hear women talk about when they come out of contesting is that I didn't have enough resources to get to all the villages and the places that I needed to go. I ran out of time and I just didn't have the money to, you know, to get the car, to get the chopper, to get the dinghy, to make those, travel commitments, because voters really want to see the women. And it's just very exhausting to engage in that very expensive exercise. Even though it's just short 8 weeks, it takes a lot of resources to carry it out.
Sure. So would you say that the fight for resources and the lack of resources generally for women is why there are no women currently in Papua New Guinea's parliament?
When women campaign in PNG, they have to campaign the way men have campaigned. And because they're coming into this space where, because men are the dominant players, they already have their own set of rules to abide by. So they've made it very expensive. They've given in to vote buying, all those things that aren't necessarily allowed. So when women come into that space, they have to, like, there are a lot of women that I interviewed and spoke to during my fieldwork from 2016 to 17 in Oro province. A lot of them expressed how they just didn't have the time and didn't have the finance, and not just to get the resources, but the way that campaigning is done. So you have the politicians, and then the first thing that a good candidate does when they get into the campaigning is to establish a committee. So because it's such a large area, the committees are sort of like the influential local leaders. You know, they could be the pastors, like a school principal, a chief, and those are the people that the candidates employ to do their canvassing for them. So these people called the committee, they sort of have to collect the voters, keep them together, and then herd them towards the polling booth when it comes election time. Now, to keep and maintain the committee or the network of people working for you, that takes a lot of time to keep them. You're sort of employing people to be your salesperson, right? And a lot of women, they'll just start with, I got my one campaign manager and my one cousin, he's gonna carry the banner and we're gonna walk the 9 yards and do this. But the way the men have been organizing it is that they only come in during the election period to give their speeches and to talk, but all of the groundwork, all of the campaigning is done by their committee members who are strategically placed in different locations and they take care of groups of voters already. So I've observed that when it comes time to the actual nomination period, when people go to, you know, nominate, when candidates go to nominate, the supporters that follow them to nominate, that is a manifestation of all the groundwork that's already been done. So the 8 weeks of official campaigning, that's just consolidating and checking up on your supporters. So, and voters know this, it's just common knowledge that if you want to contest, you have to make your intention known at least 2 years before the actual election period. Because by the time that 8 weeks come, that official election's too late, and you have to do a lot of groundwork prior to that, to build credibility as a leader. So I think I was also talking about the nomination period. When the issue of writs are issued and candidates go to nominate, usually in PNG, you'll have this whole group of supporters, convoys of trucks, people, children singing and all of that. I've observed that this level of support is just a manifestation of all the groundwork that the candidates have done 2 or 3 years prior. And then the official 8 week period is just for them to consolidate all their support groups. So actual campaigning is very long term. It doesn't really occur during that short 8 weeks that people go to, you know, nominate and officially campaign. So like it's a very long process, really.
And would you say that women have a harder time of securing those important committees and networks in the lead up, in the 2 years of lead up to an election, or do they have the same sort of capacity to build those networks as men do?
So it starts with, say you want to contest and you look in your family and you have this uncle, right, who knows, he has all the connections, he knows the local customs, he resides in the village, so that would be like your campaign manager. And then he would recruit other influential people to be on your committee. But during election time, the committees themselves, they're all very politically minded. They're looking out for which candidate is most likely to win. And those are usually men, right? So a woman may have her, you know, her close relatives by virtue of being related to them, they support her. But then that's within your small kin group or your community. But as they branch out into the electorate and they're looking for key people to back them and be their representative in each community, it gets more difficult because these committee and these gatekeepers, they're sought after by other candidates as well. So it's a very gendered space. And when they see that, oh, you know, she has the potential to win and she looks like a good candidate, they'd support you, but they're more likely to choose a man over a woman just based on the nature of our society as a, you know, patriarchal place where leadership is just naturally seen to fall on the head of the household and the men.
I'd really like to come back to this concept that you brought up before about testing the credibility of candidates. So what sort of things will people be looking out for when you're testing the credibility? What makes a candidate credible?
That's when, like, it really depends on the voter, right? Because they have their own idea of what's a credible candidate. And a lot of this term was made popular in the last election, the word hardmark, which is just, you know, talk pissing for the mark of your hand or an evidence of what your hand can do. So it's based on, it's very intrinsic Melanesian concept of reciprocity. So it's a derivative of that. So it's like what you've done, people see as evidence. And then later, when you want to contest, they look back at what you've done in the community. So if you're someone who's For example, the woman that I was sort of following during my fieldwork, she had established a tap water system in her village. So that would be like her hallmark, right? They see that and that register that she has, you know, leadership credibility because she's already done something for the community. Whereas other voters may make it more personal. Say if a certain candidate has, you know, assisted them with their daughter's bride price or their children's school fee, to them, that candidate has shown hallmark to their family, therefore their household will give him or her the vote. So the definition of hallmark, it just depends on the, you know, the context of where the voter is situated. Voters in urban areas might look at policy or, you know, projects or things like that, whereas those in the rural might look at traditional obligations being fulfilled. And to them, oh yeah, she's done hallmark, she's emfit lokamap lida, or, you know, they really contextualize it to their situation. So it's hard to brand it and generalize, you know, it depends on the voters and what they deem makes a credible leader.
I'd really like to draw out more from that, actually. I wanted to ask you about the differences between running for election in urban centres and in rural areas. Can you tell me if there are any challenges that were unique to the Oro province for the women running there?
So Oro had only, one of the reasons that I chose it was a small province. It had only three electorates. And but the thing with Oro, even though it's very close to Port Moresby, it's only 30 minutes flight. It's very expensive. And I think maybe because a lot of things come by shipment. So it's more expensive than other places. And even though there's a town center, you still need to travel out to get, in some parts you'd have to take a dinghy to go around to certain villages, and there's road network. So on that front of the logistical nature of the difficulties, that's similar to other centers around PNG, and other women would face that as well in their respective electorates. What's good about Oro society in general is that they seem to be more egalitarian. I mean, there's no outright violence or block voting that you'd see in the highlands. And I was there for a year from 2016 to 2017, and I did not hear conversations to the effect of, well, she's a woman and she's not fit to lead. That didn't come out strong. It was more of, what has she done? So they really just see them generally as, you know, it's just that you need to prove that, and that becomes difficult. So I think in PNG, Oro has had like the second highest number of women contesting since the early 2000s. So it's good the way they regard them. It's just that in the political nature, there's more things you have to do to prove that. Yes, you kind of have to show evidence before you get in. So like just going and talking about your policy and what you plan to do, that's not how it works, really.
And so on the election that's coming up this year, have you seen the same women nominate for this election? Will there be the same women that have learnt from the previous 2017 election standing again? Will we see new candidates? And how is that all going to play out, do you think?
So in the last election, we had officially they recorded 167 candidates. But then we did a bit of cleanup here at ANU of the role and some of the gender, I mean, the sex wasn't entered properly. So there were actually 179 women candidates. So that's a big increase, right? And but then we had zero elected, but we also had a lot of good runner-ups. We had a handful of women that came in second and third, so I would look out for these women. One of them was Jean Paco. She contested for the Oro regional seat, and she came in second place. Delilah Gore also came in second place. She lost by only less than 200 votes. I think she's going to contest again. We had another lady for the central province who also came third, Rufina Pita. Kessie Sawang for the Rai Coast Open in Medang province, she also came third. So we've got a handful of women coming in third and second. So I'd watch out for them as well. And Dalciana Somare, who came fourth for ECPIC provincial seat. So because they already have a network in place, it'd be interesting to see how they contest this time around.
Can you tell me about their relationship with political parties? Do most of these women start out as independents and then find a party to join or to support them? Or do they already start with the support of a particular party?
Yeah, that's like political parties, not let's say excluding 2017, but 2012 backwards. It was always looking for the candidates who are most likely to win, who are usually not women, right? But in 2012, we had Don Poirier's party, the Triumphant Heritage Party, and he endorsed two women that got elected, and they were Julie Soso and Delilah Gore. And then I think just last week, People's Party publicly endorsed four women for four seats in the National Capital District. So yeah, now they're nominating women. So we'll see how that pans out, because women have always had trouble to get nomination. When I was in Aura in 2017, just even up until the week to the nomination, I was talking to a woman candidate and she still had no one, and she was looking for a party to nominate her. So it's always difficult to look for, especially the popular parties that get a lot of traction to nominate them. But we'll see what's happening this time around. And I don't really know if it's like, it's the in thing to do now for political parties to get to build clout and nominate women, or they really genuinely want to see this agenda progress with having more women representation. We'll see when the election happens.
So you've talked about how candidates need to establish themselves quite significantly in the years leading up to an election. Can you also tell us about female legacy candidates? What are they and how do they play into the elections in Papua New Guinea?
So the legacy candidates generally refer to either wives or daughters or widows of men who've been either, prime ministers or members of parliament prior. In the last election, we saw Daltiana Somare, daughter of Sir Michael Somare. We also had Anna Skate, who was the daughter of Bill Skate, who was, I think he was prime minister from 97 to 99. In 2012, we had Jennifer Bying, whose father was also a member for the Markham Open. So these women contesting, other than having that popular last name as their branding initially, that helps with establishing themselves, and they can tap into their father's network and kin if they're contesting in the same electorate as their father. But other than that, the campaign culture is such that you have to leave your own hallmark for people to decide if they want to follow you. And the voters from before are different now from the voters who are going to be voting them, as opposed to the ones that voted for their father. So it's good that they're already popular, them by name, but then it could work both ways, because what was the, does the legacy of being this politician's daughter, what was her father like? What are people's sentiments towards that family? So I wouldn't put all my weight on it. It helps with popularity, but there's still a lot of work that the women themselves have to do.
So being a legacy candidate is not enough to be successful in election?
Not a guarantee. It helps, it makes you popular, but you still have to do the hard work.
We've talked a lot about the challenges for women facing elections and trying to get elected into the Papua New Guinea Parliament. Have there been any big wins for women at the local, provincial or national level?
On paper, now this one I'm not really sure, but we have a lot of, there are good laws, there are incentives in place to have women representatives at the provincial level and the local level, but it just hasn't come to fruition. I wouldn't say that we have. I mean, we've gone from having three to having zero. We've gone from having a discussion about 22 reserve seats, that getting straight to parliament, to having, last year there was a discussion by the parliamentary committee about having five regional seats. And I'm like, well, that to me just feels like, tokenism, because that you're coming back to descriptive representation. What can five women do, as opposed to what was wrong with the 22, reserve seats? Why can't we push forward for that? And I'm just very, I sound very pessimistic, because it just looks depressing. And unless we get some type of, you know, temporary special measure, either legislatively or with political parties, having, you know, incentivizing the party system to endorse more women. That's the only way I see going forward. If not, we're trying to, a lot of the times we try to put, you know, the onus on the women doing better and how can we help them. But what I found is that the environment is so uneven, it's so degraded, that we also have to put effort to fixing up the problems that we have with the electoral system and the political culture. Because it's not fair for the women, we to expect the women to try harder, be better, start early, do this, when the environment that they're trying to occupy is just biased against them on various levels.
So how does the experience of Papua New Guinean women fit into the broader Melanesian experience for women standing to be elected to parliament?
I think that culture that I mentioned earlier, that reciprocity thing, it's very Melanesian. I haven't looked specifically in how Vanuatu or the Solomons carry out. I've read a couple of commentary from women candidates themselves who've expressed, and they've faced similar problems with establishing themselves as leaders and the tension it creates when they go into a space that is, you know, not a woman's space to be in. So there's a lot of similarities in that respect, that it's just that strong culture of how to get by it. And then, you know, if that isn't enough, that's one thing. But what I found in PNG, and maybe the other Melanesian countries may identify as well, is that at each step of the political process, it's very gendered. So, for example, when a woman is, say, typical campaign behavior, you have to build a campaign house because that's what a lot of the men do. But when a woman does that, they're like, uh-oh. You know, the type of activities that take place in a campaign house, all the gambling and the drinking and womanizing, you know, there's this whole level of double standard when it comes to the type of activities that women can engage in, which men have been doing this whole time, right? But women come on it, you know, come with more scrutiny. And then like the technical side of it, say if a woman with her campaign team have to travel out, they will have to consider what time of day they're traveling, if it's going to be nightfall, who's going with them, security, all these things that a man candidate probably never thought of. So women actually do so much more just to appear to be on the same par as men when they're campaigning. Because, you know, they just do extra, even though on the front it looks like they're campaigning like the men, but they do so much more background work for their safety and for their access. And for their agency to come through.
Well, let's just leave it on a final thought here, Teresa. What, in your view, what do you think can be done to better help women to get elected in this election, or if that is too soon, in the elections to follow? What sort of organizations and programs do you think could help here and help women to succeed to get elected?
So I'll look at the example of in the years leading up to the 2012 election. That time was Dame Carol Kidu's last term, and she was really determined to get a type of TSM in place. So there was a lot of campaign, and you know, the media was all over it for this bill, and we had I think UN Women, the National Council of Women, a lot of people were on board talking about this issue of women's underrepresentation, right? So even though the 22 reserve seal eventually did not get passed because it did not get the numbers for the Enabling Act, the awareness around it, it just brought to the national consciousness about, you know, this agenda of women's underrepresentation. And I think that's what's missing. We only talk about women when it's election time. The whole 5 years we're quiet about it. We don't have active civil society organizations pushing this agenda. We don't have member of parliaments pushing bills for it. You know, we're not mainstreaming it in other spaces. It seems very topical, and I think that's the issue. We all have to be working together simultaneously on different fronts to mainstream it, to normalize it, you know, for it to receive traction. I think right now we just work in isolation, and we just work when, you know, it's election time. What are the women going to do? Well, you know, that was a whole 5 years that more things could have been done. So just that consecutive incremental awareness and education, civic education, not just for women, but what is the value of your vote? You know, what happens when you go to the poll? What does your vote translate to? And just get the culture of political parties, what they're for, how they build government, all these things. I think when we start doing that anytime, not just election time, that starts to sink in and it makes that change and just that consciousness and awareness. So right now, I think a lot of, we still need to work on our gender mainstreaming on different spaces.
Theresa Mecki, thank you very much for taking the time to discuss such an important and engaging topic with me today. You've been listening to the OzPNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast developed with production assistance from Darcy Milne and Josh Goading. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode.